You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good afternoon. I'm Tanvi Madan. I'm director of the India Project here at Brookings and a fellow in the Foreign Policy Program. Thank you for joining us today as we celebrate the work of Brookings Senior Fellow Steve Cohen and the launch of his latest book, The South Asia Papers, which is available for sale outside. Steve will be signing books after this event outside as well. It's also available online, and for those who will be watching this on video or on listening to the podcast, there will also be a South Asia edition that will be coming out later this year. The book itself is an anthology of Steve's writings from his 5-decade-long career studying South Asia, including his time here at Brookings since 1998. If I started listing all the books that Steve's written, let alone his articles and the details of his career as in academia and think tank world and in government, we'd go through the entire 90 minutes. So I will just say that Steve's impact in the field is truly profound. He's not just shaped and contributed to the study of South Asia through his scholarship, but also through the many scholars across generations and across borders that he has trained and mentored and nurtured along the way, along with his wife, Bobby, who is here today. Thanks for coming, Bobby. And there are other members of the Cohen family as well. Welcome to all of you. I have benefited personally from Steve's wisdom and support and knowledge, and so particularly delighted and honored to be moderating the session today. We'll be discussing Steve's book, of course, as well as his contributions to the field that he really helped create in the U.S. and beyond. We'll also be talking about continuity in change in South Asia as well as U.S. policy towards the region over the last few decades. We've got a great panel here today to discuss these subjects. Steve himself. We've got Alyssa Ayres to my right, Senior Fellow for India, Pakistan, and South Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. She was project director for the CFR-sponsored Independent Task Force report on U.S.-India relations, which is available online, I believe, and that was released last year. And she also served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for South Asia from 2010 to 2013. To Steve's left, we have Dan Markey, who is Senior Research Professor for International Relations and Academic Director of Global Policy of the Global Policy Program down the road at SAIS. He was previously at CFR as well. And from 2003 through 2007, he served on the policy planning staff at the State Department. Ed Luce, who was supposed to be here, unfortunately could not make it. He sends his apologies. But we'll start this session with some comments and observations from Steve. I would request, before we do that, that if you could please switch off the ringers on your cell phones, so we're not interrupted by any ringing. Steve's, as you do that, Steve, I'll turn the floor over to you.
Yeah, I once heard Kay Subramaniam speaking, and as Subbu was in high flight, some remark is, his cell phone went off. And it's always that taught me a lesson to, and you're glad you reminded us. I'm not sure where it's at. Here we go. Thanks very much. Good. Well, Tanvi, I appreciate this opportunity, both to you and to Brookings, for enabling me to continue my scholarly activity or inactivity for a number of years after I left the University of Illinois. And the book contains a lot of thanks to a lot of people, including you, for making it possible to have what I think is an extended, some people say, too long career. But it's been a great career, and it's not over yet. I've got one or two books left that I want to write, including a return to something I did in the 70s, that is disaster studies, and I've got a manuscript which I'd like to publish it. But let me just say a few remarks, and we'll turn to Dan and Alyssa for comments and the questions from the audience. This book includes writing that tries to explain the past, but also looks ahead to the future. So it's 19 or 20 essays and chapters from about 250 articles and chapters I've written over the past 50 years, including some of my earliest work. And as I looked at that to make a selection, I thought that in some ways that was the most interesting. The stuff I did when I was a graduate student at Wisconsin and elsewhere and in India. Some of it I think holds up as durable. But the book, I don't know if it's unique, but the book has my own comments about what I wrote then, both critical and retrospective, and also the book tries to fill in the gaps of what has been written since then on the same subject. One area I worked on was caste in the Indian Army. It really has been nothing since I wrote. I was waiting for somebody to write a book, and Steve Wilkinson of Yale actually wrote a fine book on that subject. I worked with Steve, giving him some of my notes from the British period. So I engaged in time travel. I visited regiments in South India in the Khyber Pass area. And it says visiting these regimental training centers, which were built in the 19th century, some even earlier. The regimental training center in South India was built in 1857 for British soldiers. And when independence came, the Brits marched out and the Madras regiment marched in. So there's a form of time travel. But it also looks ahead. And I shifted my interests around 78, especially when Dick Park asked me to write a book about India as an emergent power. They're looking at India's emergence or emergence. And there's a lot of euphemisms, emerging, emergent, and so forth. I've heard verge, rising, and so forth. And that's shifted me from looking at the internal role of the military to the role of the military outside, that is force, use of force across one's borders. Looking at today from the perspective of 53 years and observing changes in politics and society and regional politics, I try to imagine the future. Throughout all of this, my own angle of vision changed remarkably. I went to India as a student at the University of Wisconsin, still studying Hindi, up in a place in Landauer where the missionaries were taught Hindi. So I was able to give a short sermon in Hindi about Christianity. It was a bizarre experience for a Jew. But they taught very good Hindi, though. So then I went back to India several times as a professor, then sometimes as a think tank member. Once I went back, as a member of the Ford Foundation, as a sort of a guest scholar in Ford in 1993, which is a totally different experience. That was more like being in an embassy than anything else. So five events shaped my understanding of India. I think these were critical events, and maybe add a few. But first of all, 1965, I lived for 6 months with an untouchable member of parliament in the heart of New Delhi. So that enabled me to see India from the bottom up, literally. He was an MP from a nearby district in UP, and we go out touring with him just to see what his constituency. And the Republican Party's manifesto to get Ambedkar in the parliament was typed on my portable typewriter. We had typewriters, no computers at that time. So it was a remarkable experience to see India from a different perspective than most other Americans had seen it. He would hold a darbar, and it was really an interesting spectacle. I saw India from a different perspective, and I think very few Americans have had the privilege of seeing India from that perspective. Secondly, in 1971, I taught for 1 year in Tokyo because I couldn't get an Indian visa, and there's a chapter in the book that describes my visa problems with the Indian government, which are all forgiven, by the way. So I was able to view Asia from a different perspective, a different Asian perspective. From an ally central to the United States foreign policy, Japan. And I spent a lot of time there studying China with Keio University China specialists, who were very good, many of whom had served in the Japanese army and occupying parts of China. Their perspective was somewhat distorted, but anyway, they knew China. And I think I subconsciously asked myself the question that I heard from Jonathan Pollock the other day when you gave a talk. How do you make India the center of the world when no one else believes it to be so? Whenever I told Japanese scholars that I was studying India, they'd say, why bother? Why are you crazy? It must be nuts to do that. And so in a sense, I could tell the cultural resistance of the Japanese to studying India. I discovered that in China as well. So in so-called Asia, which is a mythical name given to a lot of regions, there's very strong differences of opinion in Asia about each other. The Indians have their own perspectives and sometimes distortions of Japan and China. That's a separate essay. In 1977, I went to Pakistan for the first time. I'm proud to say that my visa was turned down by Zulfikar Ali Bhutto. And so I had to go as a private citizen in 77. So I went to Pakistan, staying in second-class, third-class hotels, two-star hotels, traveled the country, not all of it, but enough of it, on my own, without any official intervention. It was at that trip I came to the convention of Mazzia and went back later as his guest. But that taught me that Pakistan was the un-India. It wasn't like India in many ways, but it was similar to India in many other ways. And I thought that the perspective on Pakistan that I picked up among Indians, especially New Delhi, was wrong, inaccurate. I think that it kept. So I've always felt that there was a lack of Indian expertise on Pakistan. And to some extent, my own work has been used by Indians to help them understand Pakistan. That's a separate issue. The same year, 77, my wife and I, and how many kids do we have then? Three, four, five? Five.
Three.
We lived through the Andhra cyclone. You forget these things. You lived through the Andhra cyclone in 1977, which killed between 10 and 20,000 people. We have no idea how many people actually died. So doing what most academics do when there's a crisis, I wrote a book about it with one of my former students, Raghavulu, Chaturi Raghavulu. And we toured the area right after the cyclone hit, looked at the bodies, talked to the politicians. And I'd like to republish that book in some way. I think it was probably the first social political study of a disaster in India that of any credibility. Others have written about different things, but I'd like to republish that. So that means a trip back to Hyderabad and Vizag next year. In 1985 and 87, I served for 2 years in the U.S. government in the chair that Dan eventually held, that is the South Asia person for the policy planning staff. So we were high enough to see the system, but not so high that actually influenced it. It was a great. So we had information without responsibility. Is that right?
That's about right.
Very true. And we dealt with such lowlies as deputies and secretaries in the state. But it was a great position. I worked with Gerald Schultz in the Reagan administration, which I was a Democrat, by the way. It was not a pleasant experience because I saw the damage that had been done to this country by Reagan and other ideologues. But I saw the system there, and there's some relevance for events today. Reagan, in his second term, was moderated by his wife and by people like Schultz, who I greatly admired. In a sense, whenever there's a problem, a decision, she would have a lot of influence over him, and Schultz and Weinberger and others actually provided the substance. So I think that's a lesson to be learned in case we have a who knows who becomes president in the next term. We'll see. So I acquired a different set of metrics, a different way of looking at India and Pakistan from the perspective of the State Department. I was brought in fact, to help ease the passage of the second aid package to Pakistan. But as my knowledge about the Pakistan nuclear weapons program expanded, I had a lot of questions and wrote a few memos, some of which were never made it anywheres. At that time, when people ask me, I have a little visual aid device. When people come to my office and say, "Steve, what about the Pakistani nuclear program?" I point to this, which in Hindi is Teen Bandar, three monkeys, see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. And I say, that's the Pakistani nuclear program. And later on, in a preface to a book by Howard and Teresita Schaefer, Ambassador Schaefer's here, I was able to explicate that more fully. And a Pakistani friend explained to me, well, we lied about your presence in Afghanistan, which was true. And, of course, we want you to lie about our nuclear weapons program. So, in a sense, the relationship with Pakistan, I learned then, was based on mutual lying to ourselves and to the others, which was a good learning experience. That's why the Schaefer book on Pakistan, I think, is the best book written about Pakistan-U.S. relations. So let me conclude or make four major observations. I think my original interest in my original research puzzle in South Asia was how does a state contain the army rather than being directed by the army? That is, how does a state manage the use of force without being managed by those who use force, apply force, in other words, the army? And I think the answer to that, I've been pretty consistent in the answer. I find it's kind of a boring question because it's so obvious. In the case of Pakistan inherited that part of the Raj which we associate with British militarism and military dominance. I'd say the early part of the Raj. India inherited a different part of the Raj, a part of the Raj which is more liberal and, in a sense, look forward to independence of India and of India. And I remember and one of my great experiences was in London where I interviewed a bunch of former retired Indian Army generals and also Indian officials, including Philip Mason. All of this is in the book, in that chapter in the book. And Mason was a liberal, forward-looking guy. And I thought, really, and he, you know, and India inherited that aspect of the British tradition. Pakistan inherited another aspect of the British tradition. So I think they inherited different traditions. And, of course, Pakistan is stuck in this endless loop of military intervention. And not all the interventions are blameless, in a sense. When I met Musharraf, right after his coup, throwing out Nawaz Sharif, I said, you know, it had to come because Nawaz had run off the rails, was acting unconstitutionally. I hope that General Raheel doesn't come to the same conclusion and we see another coup in Pakistan, because as I told another Pakistan Army chief, you can't run the country, but you won't let anybody else run it either. And I think that's Pakistan's dilemma. In India, the military are excluded from power and decision-making, and efficiency does suffer. I wrote a book with Sunil Dasgupta, one of my former students. This is our conclusion. Sunil here? Yeah, there, Sunil there. Okay. And, you know, we argue that civilian control of the military or civilian oppression of the military is real, and the Indian defense policy may suffer from it, but it gains an enormous amount by being directed by civilians. Pakistan, there are very few civilians who understand military and defense issues. So in a sense, it's an absence of talent. I also wrote two articles, and they're both in the book. One on Subhash Chandra Bose, I think that was my first article, and one on Indira Gandhi. And really, in there, I explored the possibility of authoritarianism in India, the authoritarian temptations of Bose and also of Indira Gandhi. And I think they're still there. You see elements of this in Modi. But in a sense, Modi's coming to office as prime minister, in a sense, will be a test of the Indian constitution. I'm pretty sure my own judgment is that Indian constitution will be able to contain any authoritarian tendencies that Modi may have. But we will see. Finally, let me say a few remarks about U.S. policy. I think it's as problematic as ever. You know, I'm now engaged in a little tiny project. It might take me a long time, looking at what American think tanks have said about India for the past 400 years, basically. Christopher Columbus being the first, right, who got it completely wrong. He didn't know where he landed. He didn't know what he saw. It was just astonishing. And then jumping quickly to Catherine Mayer, who was sponsored by the British and went to India and did a muckraking study of India, also got it wrong. And I've come across at least one American journalist who really was Catherine Mayer revisited. But looking at the American think tank studies, including yours, Alyssa, most recently, there's an interesting transition between them. I remember when I first went to India, every American, let me also point out that I tried to avoid the U.S. Embassy as much as I could. I didn't want to have any connection with them at all. That was the academic view. The embassy is a bad place because they, for reasons, are still not clear. Every American going to India was sort of expected to lecture the Indians about birth control and family planning. The next group of Americans came over and lectured the Indians about sanitation. That would include Catherine Mayo's type. Third, there was also Kashmir. Why don't you solve Kashmir? And then another wave of Americans argued with the Indians about the Soviet, their ties to the Soviet. And finally, a wave of Americans went to India and criticized their nuclear program. I saw each wave entering and leaving, you know, and the Indians greeted us all with respect, a cup of tea, very courteous, and totally ignored what we said. How are you experienced all that? I don't know if we have time for a little story.
Sure.
I remember meeting a senior Indian official who should remain very nameless, except he's dead. And he came to me and said, Mr. X, a senior American official, came to me and, quote, didn't even have time for a cup of tea, and talked to him as if he was reading a list of demands. And then I talked to the American official, and it turns out that American official, A, didn't have time for a cup of tea, B, did read a list of demands. He had his talkers, a term I learned in the State Department. You have your talkers, which are five talkers. You've got to present these talkers to whoever you're dealing with. So I thought, you know, that was complete misunderstanding how the Indians react to conversation. You know, the American official should have had a cup of tea, worked in his talking points during the conversation, but he didn't. As in a sense, the meeting was basically useless. Now, each American who came over, didn't affect the scholars that much, but certainly the officials, was infected with this disease, got to lecture the Indians about this or that. Of course, the Indians were busy lecturing us about our ills and our problems. And I remember the first time I went to India, I went up at Assam, and there were two questions I always got in this order. First was, why do you discriminate against blacks? What's your race problem in America? Having been involved in the American Civil Rights Movement, fully understood the questions. But I also, it turns out that Indians, after the 65 law changed, Howie told me about it when we met in Delhi, and the number of Indians in America increased, the complaints about American racism went down rapidly because Indians in India heard from Indians in America that they weren't being treated that badly by Americans because we had our own problem. So, and the other question was always, still would be, the number two question would be, why do you support Pakistan? Still is there. So, you know, the Indians have their own questions and they would lecture us vehemently and passionately. I think that's one of the pleasures of being in India. I met Krishna Menon, for example, a couple of times, and he lectured me many times about the evils of American self-help, but did give me a cup of tea. Now, I think that there's a new generation of American scholars combined with a new generation of scholars from other countries, including especially South Asia, really good. And they get access to documents that I could never dream of having, and they're writing good history for the most part. So I think the quality of our scholarship on South Asia is much better. In fact, I hesitated to republish my old stuff because I wasn't sure how much value there would be in it, but I think the stuff on caste and untouchabilities in India was first and really has enduring value. So I hope that these papers and my other writings will do some good and try and explain America to India and Pakistan, and also trying to explain these countries to Americans, and also to some extent these countries to each other. In other words, explaining one part of the Raj to another. Finally, I've just read a fine monograph by Dinshaw Mistry, another former, actually one of your predecessors as a research assistant. And Dinshaw, it's published by East-West Center, really good, was right when he observes that India and the U.S. are aligning across a number of issues. So I see the process inching forward during the Modi visit. And I described in one book or another, I described India as an Asian France. I don't think we need to underestimate or oversell, but we must be aware of the many things that could go wrong. I could list these, but it would make you unhappy. But there a lot of things could happen. We get another Khobragiri incident. A lot of things could happen. But another student, Sunil Dasgupta, Sunil's here today, in fact, has noted in an email today that alignment and alliance are not the same. I think that's worth repeating. Alignment and alliance are not the same. When you're allied, the alliance encourages you to overlook other differences. If you're aligned, that means you're just parallel policies in one sector or another. And the reason I like the Council on Foreign Relations report was you called for a joint venture? Yeah, joint venture, that was the theme. So India and the U.S. should get engaged in joint ventures across a number of issues, which we're doing, in fact, issue by issue. This cooperation is expanding. So limited partnership, I think it's just a joint limited partnership or joint venture is the right term. And I dissented from the report because I had some problems with it, but I think U.S.-India differences on Pakistan in particular are the real sticking point. Both of us see China as a problem in the future, which may not be a problem. The Chinese are aware of our anxieties about China. But Pakistan is not a problem for the future. I think it's problem could be a problem next week or the week after. We just don't know what the Pakistanis are up to. We don't know what the Indians are up to. And in writing a book on crises in South Asia, it turns out that several of the crises were provoked not by Pakistan but by India, most generated by Pakistan. So it's an India bore some responsibility, especially the brass tax crisis where it was conceived, designed in India. From the Indians, and Sundarji told me, this was the last time India could have a war with Pakistan and strip Pakistan of its nuclear weapons without going nuclear. And so that's hence brass tax crisis. That was the logic behind the brass tax crisis. So I think there's reason to be concerned about India-Pakistan relations. That's why I understand, but I disagree with the so-called dehyphenation. We can't dehyphenate two countries which are each other's worst enemies, or at least Pakistan's worst enemy is India, since after you figure out a way of getting around that language and rhetoric. So let me conclude there, and thank you for coming, and really ask others to come.
Thanks, Steve. And we'll come back to the question of hyphenation and dehyphenation and rehyphenation, as well as talking about what we might see in the future. Before that, Alyssa, your comments on the book, as well as Steve's work from your vantage point as both a scholar and former policymaker.
So I have a few things to say, and they're grouped into two parts. The first is a couple observations on the top chapter of Steve's book. This book is a great pleasure to read. I mean, it's a collection of all these essays, many of which I had not read earlier, so it was nice to be able to have them all in one place. But some of what Steve also does that, I mean, I just highly recommend this for everyone, including if there are students here or young scholars, Steve provides advice, his lessons in life that he's learned from 5 decades of working on the region and of crossing these sectors between an academic career, a think tank, and being a government official. I should also note that one of the things, I mean, there are a couple anecdotes in the beginning that really are laugh out loud funny. He's told you one of them with his Thien Bandar, but another one involves being in India during the kind of peak anti-American phase with Indira Gandhi. And he goes to visit some former colleagues, some friends who are faculty at JNU. And they grab him and pull him in an office and lock the door. And they say, "You don't understand what it's like now. We can't even reply to your aerograms." So I mean, it was another era, thankfully one that has passed. But it does go to show another observation, an observation that Steve makes, that there's a whole generation of Americans who didn't have kind of deep research contact or deep scholarly contact with India because of this problem of visas being denied and just a whole generation that missed out on gaining that knowledge. So Steve draws 6 lessons from his many decades-long career, and I just want to flag 3 of them. For the other 3, you should read the book. But the first one of these that I think is relevant and applicable to anyone is make lemonade. You're going to get setbacks in your career and in your life, and find a way to take that setback and turn it into something useful and valuable. And I just think that's really important for everybody to remember for everything. So I wanted to make sure to mention that. The second thing he notes, his second lesson, is the importance of what he calls time spent doing something else, building your intellectual capital. If you're not working on the book manuscript that you have underway, you can write an op-ed. That's building your broader intellectual capital. Spend a couple hours studying a language. Work on another project that's related. I don't think he means go watch TV for 5 hours, but he means doing something related that can help broaden and support your pursuits. And then the third thing that I really admired Steve for listing, which I also agree and think is critically important, is the value of learning a language, something that takes a lot of work and requires upkeep, but will create a deeper understanding over the course of a career. So that's something that Steve thought was so important that he listed it as one of his top 6 lessons. Let me make a few observations on some of the themes that Steve draws out in the set of these essays. The first that I'd like to note is the importance of India as a global power. This may sound now, today, like a commonplace observation. Well, it was not in the 70s. For my own work, I actually had tracked down and purchased a copy of that 1978 volume that Steve wrote with Dick Park. And this is it, an original, which I got from some online used book place. But really, Steve was prescient in saying back in 1978, the emerging importance of India in regional and world politics must be more broadly recognized in the United States and elsewhere. He was signaling something that at a time, I think, U.S. policymakers weren't prepared to really entertain as a prospect. India just didn't seem like it was going to rise as a great power. It was too much of a leap to be thinking about. But Steve actually called that one before anybody else. The second theme that I'd just like to flag, I imagine Dan will probably say more about that, is the great challenges that continue with Pakistan and with U.S. relations with Pakistan. If you look at some of the 3 different essays that Steve has included in the collection, one from 1986, there's a quote there, "Pakistan remains a state on the verge of disorder." I think that probably is as true today as it was in 1986. 2003, the jihadist threat to Pakistan. Again, I think that probably is as true today as it was in 2003. In 2011, Steve wrote about the botched U.S. alliance with Pakistan and what that had meant for the country's trajectory. I think we are still trying to sort through those questions even today. So I think that Steve's observations over time continue to be just as relevant as they were when he wrote them. In that same vein, I would also note Steve's work on nuclear proliferation in South Asia, strategic questions in the region. interestingly, Steve kind of not only does he write about this as a subject in his book, but he also reflects upon his own involvement in the subject and his own trajectory from being somebody who was interested in strategic studies to becoming someone who was focused on the military and kind of the sociology of militaries internally, and then returning to the strategic questions through the course of events in South Asia and through growing nuclear programs there. Again, I think these questions remain as relevant now. They've morphed. The shape of the questions are a little bit different than they were in 1964 and 67 and 74 and 68. But we're asking some different kinds of questions now about what U.S. policies should be. Two other things that Steve has mentioned. He spoke about wanting to republish the paper on disasters, and I just couldn't agree more. I think that would be great if you republished this work. I absolutely agree with you that there should be a much greater emphasis on disaster studies in the U.S. Academic and policy community. I actually found that disaster diplomacy was something that was very, very valuable and helpful. It was something that I worked on in the State Department as we worked with the government of Nepal to try to plan for a likely earthquake, because there are some kinds of disasters some countries are known to be vulnerable to. We know Bangladesh is going to have cyclones. We've done a lot of disaster diplomacy helping build cyclone shelters. We can expand our disaster relief, humanitarian assistance, cooperation, and planning exercises. This is a whole area where there's actually a lot more that we could be doing, and it can play an important role in saving lives. So I absolutely agree. I think this is a critical area. The last note I just want to, this is a hobby horse of mine, so if anybody has heard this before from me, well, you get to hear it again right now. Steve did highlight the importance of language. When you gave thanks in your acknowledgments for the kind of academic training that you had, it's not the kind of academic training that political science gives students today. And what you experienced at the University of Chicago was a kind of peak area studies, well-roundedness that I don't think people emphasize enough today. And I think that it causes people to miss out on a roundedness and an ability to understand, have a kind of flexibility of exposure to different influences. I also think that one of the challenges we face in the United States is not prioritizing the study of South Asia high enough on our list. And by that, I'm concerned about U.S. students studying abroad, language enrollments, the amount of funding that we allocate to our foreign language and area studies and our national resource centers. And when you look at the data on this, I think probably everybody in this room agrees that India and South Asia is an important region of the world. We should all place great importance on this. I think we'll all say yes. Well, you look at the data and you've got almost twice as many American students who go study abroad in Costa Rica than go to India. When you look at the data on language enrollments, there are four times as many U.S. students studying Korean than study all of the Indian languages combined. And that stat would be much worse if you were just picking Hindi instead of all of the Indian languages combined. When you look at the FLAS and the NRC data, I mean, India is in the bottom half of the levels of funding. So, you know, when we think about what it means to be engaged with and trying to have a better understanding of a complex region that is not, has its own ways of thinking about itself and its own ideas about its direction in the world, I definitely think that we as a country are not putting as much attention on the region as we should, and I think that Steve's collection of essays shows the kind of insights that result when you do put that level of attention on the region. So those are my observations. Congratulations on this collection, which really is a lot of fun to read. There's one other anecdote in there, which I won't tell probably correctly, but Steve talks about traveling in Pakistan and heading up someplace, and people started calling him Mr. Stevens. No. And then somebody asked, well, where is Mr. Cohen? He said, oh, he couldn't make it.
So. That was going up to Ladakh.
Oh, that was
with
Ladakh?
With the Indian Army. Yeah.
Mr. Daniel.
I've been called that more than once.
Well, and you've been a scholar and a policymaker, but you're now in kind of the role that Alyssa is referring to, which is an educator as well, as a professor of a global policy program. So if you could comment on how you see students looking at the region, but also your comments in the book as well. You can come back to the students if you'd like.
Sure. Well, thank you. Let me just begin by saying it is both it's an honor to be on the panel, It was a pleasure to read the book, and I echo the congratulations on your book. Just to address Tanvi's point very briefly, today I announced to my students, and I have a small group of students at SAIS down the block, that we'll be going to India for our research projects. I haven't yet heard back what they said to that announcement. I'm hoping it was a rousing chorus of hooray, but we'll see just how challenging, I will see personally just how challenging it is to bring graduate students, these are master's students, mid-career students, to do work in India in 2016. I'm sure that it will be easier than some of the challenges that Steve faced in his earlier career, but I think all is not quite so easy yet, and I'll look forward to those challenges. Let me go through some of my thoughts, beginning with thoughts about the role that Steve has had in the community, and some of these will sound familiar. I will be relatively brief in them, but I think it's worth saying. Steve is a bridge, and I mean that in three different ways. He's a bridge between the United States and the region. And you can see this, I think, first and foremost by the students that he's trained, many of whom are from the region and have returned to the region, some of whom are practicing here and basically working on these topics and building further bridges between the United States and South Asia. He's been a bridge between policy and the academy. And here at Brookings, there are more than a few people like that, but by and large, this is an unusual position to hold in the United States. His time in policy planning and his subsequent dedication to thinking about policy and strategy seriously, including some of the work that was not in this book, but is done on kind of futures scenarios and things like this. These are important. These are important and address the needs of the policy community in some interesting ways. And I think they are partly what has made Steve so valuable to Washington and to the wider policy community in the post-9/11 era, when we were lucky enough that he happened to be here. And so that's a credit. Not all academics are interested in that, and not all of them are capable of making that leap. And then he's also a bridge between regional studies and security studies. Melissa's right. I mean, his training prepared him to think as a regional scholar, to have the language and the history and some familiarity with the culture, spending time in the region. But he's also unusual in that he took this and turned it to issues, in many cases, not exclusively, but in many cases, to issues of security, issues of importance, of top importance to many U.S. policymakers. And that, too, I think is quite unusual and deserves attention. Now, Alyssa had a prop. Steve had a prop. I don't have a prop. But I did go back this morning. I keep my emails, as many as I can, on my hard drive, and I went back to the first email that I exchanged with Steve in the year 2000, so 16 years ago. And I was a graduate student finishing up a dissertation, which included a chapter on India's nuclear program. And Steve was kind enough to read it, even though he said he was in the midst of releasing one of his many books. And so he was quite busy at the time. But he did read it. He did provide comments. And a comment that stuck with me, and the reason why I wanted to go back to that first email today and reread it, I wanted to make sure if I had it right. One of his comments had nothing to do with the substance of my paper. It had to do with the way that I had characterized a statement by a relatively junior Indian academic. And I had characterized it in a kind of a sarcastic way. I was actually quoting another American academic who had done the same. And Steve said, "There's no point to this. This young guy is doing good work, and it doesn't do anyone any good to come across with this kind of a scathing, sarcastic comment." And for some reason, that really stuck with me because so few academics are gracious in that way, and who would look out for young scholars and would care to make sure that when you characterize things, you go after their ideas. And Steve's been fearless about going after ideas. I mean, he is critical about many, many things. And I've been in the room when he's been critical of them, and he's not scared to make it clear when he disagrees with you. But he doesn't bring it to a personal level. And that is something that I think we can all learn from. Second big point, some points that stood out from reading the book. I'll focus on two. The first is Steve's repeated frustration with the U.S. inability to grapple with the challenge of proliferation, of nuclear proliferation, in a regional way, to think about nuclear proliferation in a kind of a broad but focused on South Asia and Asian context, not to think about it just in terms of global or non-proliferation treaty terms. And beyond that, to think about it, he suggests, and I think he's absolutely right, you got to think about it not as a technical issue, not as a legal issue, but as a political issue, as a question of broader security and preoccupations of history, of perceptions within the region. And you can't understand proliferation if you don't think about these things. Beyond that, he adds the need to think about nuclear issues in South Asia, including China, which I think is only getting more important as time goes on, and it's not limited to the nuclear area. And then he's open-minded enough to play around with some of the concepts about the potentially stabilizing, but also potentially quite destabilizing aspects of nuclear weapons, introducing nuclear weapons into a region, and to do a kind of a net analysis or a net assessment of the consequences there, to talk about the basics of the threats posed by security, safety, accidents, onward proliferation. All of those are real, and yet there's also the potential to be something stabilizing about introduction of nuclear capabilities into South Asia as well. He's willing to entertain some of these ideas and to play around with them. Now, of course, the goal on nonproliferation has changed radically over the period of time that his book covers. I mean, in the earlier essays, it's about making sure that India and Pakistan don't proliferate, or at least don't weaponize. And then later, and now, it's more a matter of dealing with arsenals that exist and finding ways to make sure that they don't proliferate more rapidly and in ways that are increasingly destabilizing. But this argument on strategic ends or aspirations of states and the prescription which comes from that, which is effectively you need to think about altering cost and benefit calculations on the part of the actors themselves. You need to try to get into their heads and figure out what makes them tick, what might make them change, is so much smarter, in my view, as compared to focus on legalistic or technical issues of nonproliferation that makes the work shine. The second thing that I pulled from the book is an even greater frustration, and I think his remarks bore this out, with U.S. policy with respect to Pakistan. And he writes in 2011, Pakistan's current plight and troubled prospects can only be understood in the context of its having embraced the role of America's, quote, most allied ally. So he puts America and its role with Pakistan at the heart of the matter as well. He sees that in this essay and in other of his work, sees that the U.S. alliance with Pakistan actually strengthened the army at the expense, he writes, of less left liberal forces. And he makes the point that the United States has too infrequently pressed for democracy or democratization, thought seriously about promoting education or development or the civilian side of politics in Pakistan, that our focus has too narrowly been on security. Now, he also notes this is not just a U.S. story. I mean, we're not the only ones to blame here. He writes, the Pakistani paradox is that the army is a barrier to political extremism, but it cannot promote moderate institutions that would enable Pakistan to thrive. So the army is at the center both as something that wards off some real threats, but also reduces the prospect that you get positive reforms, and I think that's exactly right. Okay, third point, and I'll wrap up on this, sort of my sense on the policy issues today. And as we think about where we sit right now and the Obama administration kind of coming to a close, we have to imagine that the next White House, whatever it is going to be thinking afresh about South Asia. And my sense is that particularly as our efforts in Afghanistan have waned from where they once were, many of the issues that Steve runs through in this book, some of the long-standing issues that have come up again and again in South Asia, will begin to peek back in and really be at the fore of the next administration's thinking. So nuclear nonproliferation, the rise of India, troubled Pakistan, and Kashmir. Kashmir as both a cause and symptom of the Indo-Pakistani troubles. And I think he also points to the increasing role, as I would see it, that China will play in the region. Now, on Pakistan, I think it would not be a surprise that the pendulum is swinging back from a kind of a high point of Obama administration ambition for Pakistan, and now maybe not necessarily to the abandonment of years past, but at least to a very narrowed focus, a restricted ambition, less attention, less concern. And these, even to the things like to education and development and so on, these are the kinds of things that Steve has written extensively and critiqued the United States for doing in the past. So one of the questions in my mind is, as the U.S. Vision on Pakistan narrows, as we devote less attention and less resources to Pakistan, are we going to commit some of the same probably misguided policies as we have in prior decades? And on India, with the Modi visit looming, it's really encouraging to see how much the relationship has changed compared to the bad old days that he writes about in the book. But the question for the next administration is how to keep up this positive momentum. What are the lessons from history that will allow us to do this, to extend our role with India from narrow points, I think, of defense cooperation to a broader agenda? How exactly are we going to do that? And then I think I'll wrap up on Kashmir, because very little has been said on this, but Steve writes about it in the book extensively. And one of the things that I thought was most interesting, he says, time will not heal Kashmir, in a 1995 essay. And he suggests that the only thing that the United States shouldn't do is nothing. I have to say, for the last two U.S. administrations, we've done relatively little on Kashmir. It hasn't been the centerpiece of our focus there, except when it comes to crisis management. So the question there that I have for the next administration is, will it take on a more ambitious approach in Kashmir? Will it also see that time does not heal anything? Will it also believe that the only thing we shouldn't do is nothing? I don't know, but I think these are the kinds of questions people should be considering, and Steve's book is a good way to get them into it. So thank you.
Thanks, Dan. Steve?
I want to add 2 points because I skipped a page in my brief. And Dan has raised one of the issues, which is nuclear weapons. There's a long chapter in there, something I wrote in the 80s or 90s, about my views on proliferation. And really, it argues that I agree with your comments. Let there be one, two, or three exceptions to the NPT, Israel, Iran, even Pakistan. So I think we have to see it in a regional context. But an earlier essay I wrote, which is not in the book, but you're the first to hear this, I'm going to put it on a website. It's on Twitter, and we'll put it on the book website. I wrote a piece in 1964-65 on why India should acquire tactical nuclear weapons. Think about that for a minute, to deal with the Chinese. Because then, quote, the Pakistanis were not a nuclear threat, unquote. So I want to republish that article one way or the other, but I quote from it in the book. But that showed that my training as a nuclear strategist, turned off by Herman Kahn, among others, set me in a different way. I went to India, in fact, because it was one place in the world where NATO at least was saying sensible things about nuclear weapons. The other point I want to make, general point, which nobody's touched on here, is, and I learned this from Claude Auchinleck and other British Indian Army generals, is that the partition of British India destroyed the strategic unity of South Asia. The unity had been created by the Mughals, and the British Raj simply carried it forward and added muscle to it in the shape of the Indian Army, which is what my dissertation was about. So Indian power now, and that's India's great strategic problem. When Modi comes here, he has one big strategic problem, that is how to get Pakistan off our agenda. But Pakistan is not a trivial state. You know, India had its chance to destroy Pakistan at one point, and in a sense, they chickened out. That's what Brass Tack was about. And after Pakistan went nuclear, they couldn't use force to destroy it. I was asked by a senior Indian strategist who shall remain nameless, Steve, you take care of the nukes, we'll take care of the Pakistan army. And I thought, no, that doesn't work. And I thought about it, but it didn't work. So in other words, you can't disarm Pakistan. So Indian power as a whole, which is increasing, is always going to be Indian power minus Pakistani power. And the conclusion I draw is that South Asia cannot produce a strategic hegemon in the future at all. It can't be India. It can't be Pakistan.
Thanks, Steve. Steve, I'm going to Alyssa and Dan, and you've talked about a number of themes that continue to resonate over time, things you've looked at before, and are still kind of some of the questions and the themes we grapple with today. What are the biggest changes you've seen in the region?
The decline of anti-Americanism willing to treat us for what we are or what we would like to be.
In all of South Asia or just in India?
In India in particular. In Pakistan, anti-Americanism has grown, but for good reason. When you bomb your closest ally regularly with drones, you're not loved in that country. So we've been bombing Pakistan regularly with drones. And the Pakistan government will admit, in fact, that some of that drone attacks were actually on behalf of Pakistan. So the anti-Americanism in Pakistan is very deep. But sympathy for the United States as a culture and as a country and as an idea is powerful both in India and in Pakistan. So I think that's our greatest strength.
Alyssa, I'm going to turn to something Steve said about kind of Prime Minister Modi's visit here and his kind of focus on Pakistan. In the region, however, Prime Minister Modi has made it a point to note that India's South Asia policy will not just be Pakistan policy. Mm-hmm. And I want to kind of talk about the other South Asian countries that we rarely talk about, but that are getting attention. We talk to some extent, and Steve said the region doesn't get enough attention to some extent and to quite a large extent in India's case. India, Pakistan, Afghanistan are talked about for different reasons, of course. But in terms of as somebody who's worked on U.S. policy towards Bangladesh, Nepal, Sri Lanka, how much attention do these countries get? And when we talk about South Asia, how much more attention do we need to pay to these countries?
So I think we've seen ups and downs with the U.S. policy community and U.S. General attention to the region. With the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, I think you saw, in fact, there was a period where I'd argued between, 2005 and maybe 2011 or so, the term South Asia here in Washington had almost, in a sense, stopped including India. I mean, I would go to things and people were talking about South Asia and it was only about Afghanistan and Pakistan. So I think India is now back in that concept of what South Asia means. For the other countries, the smaller countries, I think it really depends on what the issue is. I think the level of attention is much lower than it would be for any of these three other countries. But certainly in the case of Bangladesh, there is a very, very deep economic relationship with the Bangladeshi garment industry and U.S. Retail brands. Sort of footwear and garment apparel manufacturers. So when you had the collapse of Rana Plaza in 2013, all of a sudden this was front page news. I mean, I would walk into a store and hear people talking about Bangladesh, which you almost never hear happening. You don't hear that as much anymore. That's off the front lines. Sri Lanka, you hear about from time to time ambiently. In the policy community, there actually was a lot of attention to Sri Lanka, particularly with the end of the conflict in 2009 and moving forward from there. The United States sponsored some resolutions in the UN Human Rights Council, for example, focused on Sri Lanka. So in the policy community, a lot of attention. I'm not sure that a more narrow issue like something happening in the Human Rights Council gets broader attention. Not as much attention to Nepal, I am sorry to say. It is a great country, but not as much attention. It's just much smaller. There's a lot of development and humanitarian focus. With the earthquake, there was a lot of news coverage, but, of course, not sustained. Now, of course, Nepal faces the issue of rebuilding, and the press has kind of gone away, and the assistance hasn't been delivered out to where it needs to go. So that's something that we should be focusing on, but I think it's off the radar screen. Bhutan and Maldives, pretty much off the radar screen. So I think you're all well aware.
The ambassador, Rich Verma, just made his second visit to Bhutan.
Dan,
I was at a conference recently where one of the things that, it was a day and a half long conference, and one of the themes that came up, and this constant question of, that can we really talk about South Asia in the SARC sort of way anymore? That with India's Act East and Look West, with Pakistan looking to the Middle East, but also now with the China-Pakistan economic corridor as it becomes a reality, and India's attention to the Indian Ocean region along with other countries as well, can we really think about a South Asia as we did before? Can it be studied that way? Is the U.S. government structured? And I'd like all of you to comment because, Alyssa, I know you and Steve have talked about how the U.S. government is structured to deal with the region. Dan, to start with you, Can we think about this in the same way? How do we think about the role of China in particular, but also the U.S. and Japan in this region?
Sure. I mean, the short answer is I think you're exactly right. The region doesn't make that much sense, the region of South Asia, as an analytical unit. In some ways, maybe it never did, but it makes less and less sense as you look forward. Principally, in my mind, because of China, less so from some of these other developments. But the one I'll give you, for instance, there's a kind of a factlet that gets tossed around frequently that sort of intra-regional trade in South Asia is less than in any other region in the world, something along these lines. And I've always hated that one because I think about their trade with China, which is a next-door neighbor, which is ruled out by the artificiality of drawing where South Asia is from being an intra-regional trade partner. And I think, how silly is this? So, you know, which isn't to deny the obvious historical connections between India and Pakistan and all the rest, but to suggest that from an analytical perspective, it doesn't make that much sense because it doesn't tell you what's actually happening in terms of connections between these countries and their nearby neighbors. And as China becomes more invested in this region and is likely to play a greater role on every front, from starting on a commercial level and trade and so on, moving into infrastructure development and investment, and then beyond that into diplomacy and military and strategic issues, as that happens, this will be less the case. That said, on the pure bureaucratic management front, I mean, you got to draw the line somewhere. You have to have a bureaucracy that has pieces to it, and all of those lines, wherever you draw them, will be problematic. One of the things that I've found is if you do not have a South Asia, or as it has been, a South Central Asia bureau separate from the rest of Asia, then you're likely to get trampled on by big issues having to do with China and Japan and East Asia and Northeast Asia. So there can be utility to hiving it off and having a separate piece. But we all saw, you know, many of us watched as the AFPAC thing got created. Some of us thought, including myself, thought there might be utility in bringing Afghanistan and Pakistan back together because, as is often forgotten, they were actually separated before the AFPAC thing happened. And then we all looked in horror as AFPAC became a thing that became kind of exclusive from other connections. And so anywhere you draw the line, you're going to have a problem. You just need to be cognizant about what the likely consequence of that bureaucratic redrawing is going to be.
And, of course, the lines are drawn differently in the Defense Department
and
the State Department.
Yeah.
Steve, you've written about this.
I think a few points. The original title of this book, this collection, was going to be a parody of Arnold Toynbee, Between Oxus and Indus. It was going to be Between Hindustan and South Asia. Hindustan was the name of the entity that the Mughal Empire called itself, which was a unified South Asia from Calcutta or East Bengal to the Khyber Pass. And it was the largest integrated economic zone in the world at the time, astonishing. And the British simply took it over by crook and by hook, or whatever you want to call it. And in a sense, the British Raj was the largest integrated economic unit in the world. That's why the fact that South Asia is chopped up now is so important. Another historical factoid, which is often forgotten, it was the United States that made Chinese unification possible by defeating Japan. When we defeated Japan in 45 and in 47, the British partitioned South Asia, we enabled the creation of another Asian great power and essentially destroyed South Asia or India as an Asian great power. I think those are two things that can't be changed. We don't want them to be changed, in fact. We don't want Japan to come back as a major balancer of China. Some do, but Donald Trump may, but I don't.
We might come back to that. Lisa, do you have anything on the lines between and potentially on a realignment of how the lines are drawn by a new administration?
Yeah, I think that the creation of a separate AFPAC entity in the State Department makes it harder to coordinate because it's just parallel structures make things harder to coordinate. I mean, if you've got a proliferation of more structures, you have more people who are not working on the same thing all the time. It just makes it more challenging. I think Dan would have been in the State Department when the Central Asian countries were moved out of the European Bureau and put in. I mean, Don was maybe in it then, too. So they would both remember what that was like. I think the idea of that configuration was to try to make sure that there was more attention to thinking about a broader region of economic and political engagement from all of the countries all the way out to India as a kind of regional economic vortex. Having the AFPAC piece carved out of that makes that harder to do. So, I mean, I am not saying that we should spend less attention focused on Afghanistan and Pakistan. These are issues that require a lot of diplomacy, a lot of multilateral diplomacy. You need to have a lot of people who are doing the, you know, footwork on all of this, having lots of conversations all the time. But I think it makes more sense to have those countries back in a regional bureau so you have one assistant secretary who is the senior person for the region, and it makes communication and coordination, at least the lines are a lot clearer.
And the concern that that you see from some in India that this will lead to a re-hyphenation of U.S.-India relations being seen in the U.S. from the U.S.-Pakistan prism, you've written that you don't think that's going to happen.
I think that is a complete misinterpretation of what the idea of hyphenation and de-hyphenation means. I think Steve started to get at some of these questions in his opening remarks too. But you know, de-hyphenation was a process of trying to shift the way the United States formulated its foreign policy from trying to balance every action taken with one country with something similar toward the other. The de-hyphenation moment in the Bush administration was to say, we have different interests with India than we do with Pakistan, and we are going to pursue those separately. We're going to look for the best relationships we can have with each country. What Steve is now getting at today is this question of, well, for example, with the terrorism issues in Pakistan, it becomes more challenging to try to pursue answers to that, more challenging to try to deepen our strategic relationship with India when there are you know, unresolved sources of terrorism in Pakistan that you know, the country is not doing what it should be doing. It makes it much more difficult as a U.S. policymaker to try to work with both countries on parallel tracks if we are not able to address that specific question.
Steve, we've got a few months left in the Obama administration and a big, potentially a big Modi visit coming up in June. But since we've just got a few months left, what is your assessment of the Obama administration's policy towards South Asia, towards the region as a whole?
Well, I'd give it a B+. Not really, still a professor. Not really creative and imaginative, but I think they learned something from the experience. They managed the Pakistan relationship pretty well, even though it was in deep crisis for a while. And I think they've continued the tie with India. But the overall, if I had my druthers, I'd put in bronze above the desk of the president and everybody else. We look for the common interest we have with India regarding Pakistan, which is to make Pakistan a moderate country. We have that common interest with Pakistanis also. Maybe not with the Pakistan army, but with most Pakistanis. I think we should focus and keep in our minds the shared interest we have with a state in South Asia, whether it's India or Pakistan, and not whether it conforms to our laws or not, because that's, in a sense, the NPT, in fact, leads us in different directions. So I think that's the critical thing. So what's the common, most important thing we have in common with India? I think the one thing is not only see India's development and emergence continuing as a democracy. So I think that's a vital of American interest in its own right, but also the amelioration or the moderation of Pakistan, because you can't destroy Pakistan. That would be too costly, too dangerous for everybody. And Pakistan isn't, well, assist the Pakistanis in achieving regime change in their own country.
Dan, you can comment on that, but also for the next administration, you mentioned at least a couple of questions. But for the next administration coming in, there's obviously be a lot of attention on the Middle East, whether the president likes it or not. But in terms of South Asia, what are some of the key challenges and opportunities that you think a new administration, especially in its first year, first couple of years, might face?
Well, look, I'll try to combine the two. I mean, my assessment of the Obama administration, one of its core strengths on South Asia is in some ways reflected in the upcoming Modi visit, which is, in spite of the fact that the world has been enormously challenging and has pulled the United States in a wide number of different directions where clearly this administration would prefer not to be. It still has expended time and attention at senior levels on India, and not in a moment of crisis or in the service of one particular agenda, say the civil nuclear deal as the previous administration had, but in a workmanlike fashion that suggests a desire to maintain that over the long term. Now, you can criticize it for not having more breakthroughs or not seeing, you know, not making more progress on this, that, and the other, but simply given all the other things that are yanking the United States in different directions, the fact that so much time and attention on India, I think, is worth maybe a higher grade even than Steve gives it. On Pakistan and Afghanistan, however, it depends how you construct your grading framework. Think back to how the Obama administration came in. And in 2009, the kind of attention, ambition, resources, rhetoric was through the roof. It was, and now, Steve, I haven't worked on South Asia very long compared to you, but it had to be in the most exciting time for U.S. policy on South Asia, I would think ever, and like 2009, in that time frame, maybe more exciting, you know, than the heady days of the Mujahideen and all that business, because this was out front and center. And so if that's the level of ambition, if you're grading on ambition, we seriously undershot the mark. That's not a fair grading, but I think it's worth thinking about, you know, where that ambition was, where we actually ended up. We're not in crisis with Pakistan right now, but as I noted before, the pendulum has swung in a direction where I think the consensus view is narrowing and reducing ambition, narrowing attention, reducing resources. That may be the right way to go, but until, and this is what the challenge for the next administration, is tying that approach with a vision of how that isn't just a way to save money and attention of U.S. top leaders and actually has the potential to get you something better. I don't see it. So that, to me, is the challenge. How do you actually construct a vision, a strategy for dealing with Pakistan that has something marginally better, or at least, at the very least, can give you some promise of warding off something significantly worse? Narrowing of attention in and of itself doesn't do that. So that's going to be the challenge, as I see it.
Steve, do you want to say, I'm going to go to Alyssa and then the audience.
An interesting question, or a different question, would be, how would you grade India and Pakistan in terms of their relations with us? And I'm not sure. I think the Indians get a pretty good grade. Pakistanis, we don't.
When we do this panel discussions at Brookings in Delhi, we'll do the reverse. Alyssa, any comments on both how you would assess the current administration, with the caveat that you were you served in the administration?
It's not fair to ask me to grade my
own
work.
Okay, well,
I'll be an easy grader on my own work.
That's why I wasn't going to ask you. I was going to ask more in terms of the incoming administration, whichever way that goes. What are the key challenges and opportunities that they are likely to face?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've hit on them. In fact, in the sort of perennial big questions that are contained in Steve's collection of essays, I do think as a kind of security question, there is this perennial issue of thinking about what the dangers are of nuclear proliferation. That's going to be something that anybody would have to think about. Finding a way, as Dan said, to keep the momentum going with India. India is growing fast. It is now the fastest growing major economy in the world. It is a very ambitious country. It has its own things it would like to be doing on the world stage. So maintaining that, keeping the defense relationship growing as it has been, very important. We touch on a lot of these recommendations in our task force report. So I think you see a lot there that would be similar sets of issues to what anybody would be looking at today. There could be wild card issues. I mean, God forbid, a terrorist attack that forces people to suddenly have to move into crisis mode. That would be the thing that I would, like the 2 a.m. call that you worry about getting.
We're going to turn to questions. If you could please keep your questions short, make sure they're question and there are mics around. So if you could please wait for the mic. I'm going to take some questions in clusters of three. We'll start on this side. Stanley Roth over here first.
A quick comment, then the question. I spent 7 years working for the late Congressman Solars to get legislation creating the South Asia Bureau in the 80s. Astonishingly, it was argued at the time it was unnecessary. It was linked or swallowed up by the Near East Bureau, and it was argued that a mini regional bureau would only hurt policy, not help it. Now it's inconceivable to think of it being the two bureaus being together shows how times have changed. My question is for Steve or anyone else who wants to comment, but about the future of India-China relations. I know there are many people in this town, not really in the administration, I think, who think that India should be a card against China in the way China was viewed as a card against the Soviet Union, which doesn't seem real. But what do you see as the both the potential and the limitations on the India-China relationship?
Steve, we'll just take two more. We'll take a question over there and then back there as well.
This is Larry from Embassy of Pakistan. 2 points. One, the notion that Pakistan is a problem to be solved. And when we talk about the opportunities and challenges, we end up again regarding the opportunities, India, and challenges that comes to Pakistan. Again, looking like, would that be a good approach to do that? That's for Dan and for Steve, sir. Do you think that with what's happening, the reality on the ground, interventions or interference in Pakistan by agencies from India, as proved by one of the latest apprehensions as well. So have we gone down again to the three bandars, not seeing, you know, the same that you referred, that are we again in the same situation of not seeing what is happening, not ready to listen about that?
And the question over there.
Hi, my name is Sundar, graduate student of government at Georgetown and an intern with the India chair at CSIS. I wanted to thank Brookings for this wonderful panel. Plenty of things I learned today. But my question was, I was going to zoom out a bit of the South Asia map and wanted to see that, obviously, the Prime Minister makes a number of visits to the U.S., but every time he visits visits Russia, he also lays out a formal diplomatic statement that makes it look that India is equally serious with the Russians. And I just wanted to ask if does that create an ambivalency when U.S. looks at India and the overall India-Pakistan-China triangle when it addresses us? Thank you.
Steve.
I think, Stanley, that the South Asia Bureau was necessary, desirable. But South Asia itself does not carry its own weight. In fact, I think the India-Pakistan dispute hurts India and Pakistan. And in the case of Pakistan, it's a state that's been mangled by its own army to some degree. And I go back to my interview with Field Marshal Claude Auchinleck, last commander of the old Indian Army. And Auchinleck was almost in tears when he said the partition of the two armies was the greatest tragedy of his professional career. But there were Indian politicians like Ambedkar, who saw that you had to get the Punjabi Muslims out of Pakistan, out of India into Pakistan, because they would dominate whatever country they were in, which turned out to be true. So I think Pakistan has the potential to be a major decent state, I compare it with South Korea, but it still has to get its act together. But the world is waiting.
Alyssa, do you want to respond to any of the...
Which one?
Any of the questions, the Russia question, the question from the gentleman from the Embassy of Pakistan, or the question about...
On India's... Are you saying, does India's relationship with Russia create ambivalences in its relationship with the United States?
Or ambivalence here about...
So India has never made any claim that it was seeking an alliance relationship from the United States. So that is not a surprise to anyone. And if you look at the many strategic partnerships that India has forged over the course of the last, 10 years or under, it's with all of the major powers and a number of other powers around the world. So the answer is, I think, no, that's not a surprise in any way. I think people are prepared to see India have its eggs in a lot of different baskets. India has very strong ties with Japan. Incidentally, India has signed a vision statement for a possible strategic partnership with China. So I think there's a lot happening for India in the way that it crafts its relations with many other countries. Sir, to answer your question, I think it would be a wonderful day if there were an opportunity to think about opportunities with Pakistan. I think Pakistan should be thinking about what it could be doing to better its economy and to be delivering training and education and better things for its citizens. I mean, the fact that there are challenges there is something that I think speaks directly to the challenges that Pakistani citizens face. So, I mean, I think this is something that Pakistanis have to answer within themselves.
Dan, do you want to...
Yeah, just quickly on the future of India-China relations, you know, I think it's maybe one of the most important questions for the region, and then by extension because they're so big for much more than the region. But it's also fascinating because you get these really different impulses voiced by, let's just stick with, by Indians themselves. On the one hand, there's both a kind of a traditional connections with China having to do with more of a non-aligned movement style, developing country, big country, not seeing the U.S. leadership in the global system as one that necessarily serves their purposes particularly well on trade or climate or things like this. And there you see that combined with commercial interests and business and investment interests in seeing more Chinese money flowing into India. There you see an overlapping of India-China interests. And then, very much from a different perspective, you hear Indians, I hear Indians, of a more kind of geopolitical, hawkish variety talking about their concerns about China as a threat and also principally seeing Pakistan as a wing of Chinese power, of encircling Chinese approaches that will harm India's capacity to rise as a power into the future. And the subsidiary point on that is India's complaining to the United States that we don't appreciate what China is doing in Western Asia as threatening to India, in the same way that we seem to appreciate what China is doing in East Asia as threatening to our other partners and allies, that there's a differentiation there in our perspective. So really fascinating and different views. And that deep uncertainty is the overlay that we have to think about the future of the relationship within.
Question over here.
Thank you very much for a great presentation. Ms. Ayers, I may have missed something. My name is Elliot Hurwitz. I'm a former World Bank staff member and member of the intelligence community. And I worked in the State Department in 1982 to 86 under Secretary Shultz. You talked about nuclear proliferation in South Asia, and unless I missed something, it hasn't been discussed that much. So could you please explain what you meant by nuclear proliferation in South Asia? I mean, we know that Pakistan and India have nuclear weapons, but are there other countries that you're talking about?
I'm talking about Steve's book and the essays in his book about...
Okay,
India.
I'm sorry, I bought the book, but I haven't read it yet.
Question over here.
Yeah. We hope there's no other
countries. Hi, Dave Ramaswamy. You know, those who can make you believe historical absurdities can make you commit policy atrocities. So when you talk about the hyphenation with India, Pakistan, it stems from the understanding that, you know, the starting from, say, the Mughal Empire and then the British Raj were the kind of best hours of modern-day India and Pakistan. The Maurya Empire stretched from Afghanistan to Assam. So going forward, how does the opportunities created in the commercial space in India with smart cities infrastructure and also the security aspect containing a rising China versus combating radical Islam? So what's the alignment with India and the U.S. in these regards? Thank you.
We'll take these two questions over here and then go to the panel.
Hi, I'm Ayush. I'm a student of transnational studies and economics. My question is related to Nepal. So what do you think about India's conduct in the border blockade that happened recently after the earthquake and in regards to Nepal's constitution? And mind you that Nepal's constitution was passed with a large majority in the Constituent Assembly. Don't you think that the United States' embracement of India and India's foreign policy has rather created problems inside South Asia?
And the question over there, and then we'll go to the panel.
Hi.
Jay Kansara with the Hindu American Foundation. Having seen the birth of Bangladesh in 1971, can you give some analysis on its birth as a secular nation and then its dissension into what is now kind of a religious, where religious extremism is a hotbed? And also, do you feel that the American president now or in the future should apologize for the failure of the U.S. administration in 1971 to prevent the killing of primarily secular Bengalis and Hindus? Thank you.
Alyssa, do you want to start and then we'll go down to that?
So the tail end of your question was a view on India's relations with Nepal over the Constitution and the blockade, and then what was your last piece? So I don't think that the U.S.-India embrace causes problems for India-Nepal ties. I would separate these two pieces of your question. I think that India has a very firm belief on what it was hoping to achieve in pressing the government of Nepal to revise its constitution, to provide greater space for the Madhesi community and for rights. I'm sure you're very familiar with this because you've asked the question. Now, the government of India says that they did not impose a blockade. They say that the truck drivers were hesitant to enter the border because of the protests that were going on. I am not able to adjudicate that dispute. I don't know the answer to that. I'm not privy to any special information. I do agree this was a tragic situation after this earthquake. The assistance has not reached people in high villages where the earthquake epicenter was. So there's still all this assistance that hasn't reached people. There were shortages of fuel and food. I think this was a tragedy. I hope that protests, which I gather are taking place again, don't create other problems for supply convoys to cross the border. But I don't think that the United States and its partnership with India necessarily creates problems at all for India's ties with Nepal.
Anything on the current situation in Bangladesh or any comments?
I'll let Steve take that.
Steve and Dan?
Yeah, no, I don't think the U.S. needs to apologize for its past policies, even though I strongly disagreed with them, American policy during the East Pakistan uprising. But I think that's been widely misunderstood and misrepresented by a lot of other people. I won't go into the details, but in the case of regional economic cooperation, I think that's an important question. I think American policy should be to offer incentives, especially to Pakistan, maybe assurances to Pakistan with India, that the expansion of Indian economic power throughout the subcontinent, say transit to Afghanistan, would not threaten Pakistan. Pakistanis are desperately afraid of Indian soft power, Indian economic power. We talked to senior Pakistani generals about this. And they say if you give them an inch, you'll take a mile. So in a sense, there are ways of providing assurances and guarantees and verification that the Indians limit their expansion to those agreements. So in a sense, to rebuild an integrated South Asia economically, and I begin it with economics. But I think there's an opportunity for India and Pakistan to work together in Afghanistan. The Indians are providing schools and education. The Pakistanis are providing terrorists and extremists. Well, let Pakistan provide something useful. Let the Indians also expand their role. So in a sense, there's an agreement, the possibility of an agreement there. I understand the U.S. government may be coming around to it. When it says we go back to Bonn, we involve the Iranians, which we couldn't do in the past, but we might now, the Russians, the Chinese, the Indians, and the Pakistanis in a consortium of countries around Afghanistan. So I think I would begin there rather than say Kashmir. And an Indian transit agreement through Pakistan could be part of that larger agreement.
Dan, quick comments, and then we'll go for a final round.
Sure. Let me just pick up on the earlier question about Pakistan, and only to make an observation that I've recently written on China-Pakistan economic corridor. And if you're thinking about opportunities for the United States and Pakistan, the question in my mind about the China-Pakistan economic corridor is, will it be as transparent and inclusive as the Chinese say? And if so, will that actually make space for outside investors, including American investors, to be involved in useful ways, and not just on the commercial side, but also U.S. assistance moving forward. That's an area where there's potential commonality of interest and opportunity, but as yet we haven't seen that it's a door that we can walk through. But I would add that, unfortunately, right now, you live in Washington, you hear the tenor of the mood about Pakistan is a narrowing and a constraining of ambition and a refocusing on military and security and intelligence counterterror issues, not on an expanding, broadening vision of opportunities.
Could you say one thing? Steve makes the point in his book that one of the problems is that in the United States, our Congress never delivered trade privileges to Pakistan to help create an incentive that would really push more on economic growth. So
we have time for three quick questions. Please keep them quick so that everybody can get to their next appointments in time. We'll start with a question here, then move here, and then back there.
My name is Kannan, and I have a question for Professor Cohen. So you gave a B-plus grade to the Obama administration. What would be your grade to the Modi administration, given that he came into office without even having a visa privilege to come to this country? Now, it's been 2 years. What would be your grade to Modi administration vis-a-vis their work towards the U.S.? Thank you.
Question over here, Neham.
Thank you, Tanvi. This is Dr. Nisar, and I must congratulate you for organizing such a panel of distinguished people. And as Alisa mentioned about dehyphenation by Bush administration, I think this is very fair analysis. The way USA has independent relations with India, of US relationship with Pakistan, in the same way Pakistan has independent relations with China than Pakistan has with USA. And as Tanvi mentioned that Pakistan is looking toward Middle East, I think I will be inclined to differ on this. I believe USA, India, and even Pakistan, all these three countries are looking eastward. And as Dan mentioned about...
Dr. Chaudhry, sorry, but if
yes,
you could just get to your question.
As Dan mentioned about the narrowed down relationship, India is not a country, it's a continent. One-fourth of the population lives in that area. Pakistan is a reality. Both are neutral states. And America will continue to remain engaged in this policy. Steve, you have covered for half a century, you combed the territory of India. All these four wise men, there are only two kinds of people in this world, wise and otherwise. And this, you belong to the first category. Please suggest, all of you should give your suggestion, how can they reconcile? How can they become good neighbors? If they could live for centuries together, why can't they learn to live as neighbors together? Thank you.
We have a lot of wise women also around, not just wise men.
Otherwise,
even more so. One final question there.
Good evening. I'm Pranay from Takshashila Institution, Bangalore. I have a short question. What are U.S. national interests in each of the constituents of South Asia?
Steve, we'll start with you to answer or all of the three questions.
Let me talk about the grade for Modi. In my grading system as a professor, I should make this clear. I think if the student learns something from the experience and the paper is reasonably well done, gets a B. If I learn something from the experience, if it's creative and original, it gets an A or an A minus. In other words, there's something new or creative in Modi's foreign policy. And I think he began at a very high level with the invitation to Pakistan in particular to attend his inauguration. But it wasn't necessarily his fault. It sort of degenerated into squabbles. So I'd give him a B plus, verging on an A minus. You know, that the semester isn't over yet. He may actually do something more impressive. You know,
is that for foreign policy in general or towards the U.S.
Foreign policy in general. Towards the U.S., he gets an A+. He brilliantly handled, or his relationship with Obama was brilliantly managed, despite his monogram suit, which Obama must have thought was kind of silly. But he knew how to handle or deal with American Congress in a way that no other Indian prime minister has been successful. For this, of course, I think his supporting staff gets a lot of credit.
Steve is the wisest of wise men. Do you want to respond on either the U.S. national interest question or Nisar's question?
Actually, for both of them, I'd say read my books. I wrote a book on shooting for a century, which ended very pessimistically about India-Pakistan normalization. But I concluded in the end, it's not in the book, that it's better that two ships pass in the night than rather two ships collide in the night and sink. So it could be worse in the case of India-Pakistan, but the book has a lot of suggestions and arguments about what could be done positively. I'll stop.
John.
Yeah, I hate to say it, but due to the constraints of time, I would reiterate what Steve said on the U.S. interests in South Asia. Read his book.
Alyssa, you get the last word.
We endorse that. We're here to celebrate Steve's book and half a century of his scholarship, so read the book.
So this is both support and endorse. You can buy the book outside. Steve's going to be signing the book outside if you want to get your book signed. Thank you all for coming. A special thank you to the Coens, all of whom in ways have contributed to this book being possible. And thank you, Steve. Thank you, Dan and Alyssa. And thank you, Steve, for not just your scholarship, but for your mentorship as well.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.